Hello and welcome to the Peter A. Allard School of Law History Project. My name is Alexander Starr and I'm the History Project Student Coordinator. Today we are interviewing Judge Cunliffe Barnett of the class of 1966. Welcome.
Thank you.
Could you tell us a bit about yourself?
Well, my childhood and public school years were spent here in Vancouver. I graduated from Prince of Wales High School in 1954. Back in those days, it was a very small high school. My memory is that there were only 28 of us in our graduating class. I expected that I would go to UBC and become an engineer. But my mom and dad were insistent that I apply to MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And when, to my surprise, I was accepted, I did go to Boston. I graduated from MIT with dual degrees in geology and geophysics. That was one degree. And a second degree was business administration. And I graduated in 1959. In the course of obtaining the second degree, the business administration degree, I took a couple of introductory law courses, and by the time I returned to Vancouver in 1959, I knew that I was really not wanting a career as an engineer, a scientist, or a geologist. And I began the process of applying for admission to the UBC Law School. But that very quickly ended when my wife and I received the news that she was expecting. So I spent the next four years working as a field geologist for Imperial Oil in Alberta, as a high school teacher teaching math and physics and chemistry in Red Lake, Ontario, which was a northern, very northern mining town. And then as a lumber broker in the family business here in Vancouver. In the spring of 1963, an employment counselor confirmed my thoughts that career-wise, I was a round peg trying to fit into a square hole. And I was told that persons with my characteristics were best suited to become pastors or lawyers. And so it was that in the fall of 1963, having sold my new Volvo and increased the mortgage on our home, I entered law school at UBC. And there were no Canada student loans or any student loans available in those days. I had a very sympathetic banker, I would have to say. I was a so-called mature student in the class of 1963. I never regretted the fact that I was out working for 4 years. I would have gone back teaching if it weren't for the fact that my dad really didn't like that idea. And so I said, well, he tried to persuade my wife, Mary, that I shouldn't leave the family business. And he did persuade my aunts to lean on me. And I said to myself, well, you know, if they're all going to be mad at me or upset with me or whatever for not staying in the family business and supporting my family, they might as well be really shocked. And my dad came around after my first term when he saw that I was a better student in law school than I had been at MIT.
Do you remember some of your first impressions at the law school?
Oh, yeah. I remember that before classes got started, we were gathered in the library of the old law school, the really old law school, and we were told to look at the person sitting beside us and to understand that in second year, only two of this little group of three would be returning. In other words, you know, we were not so carefully selected as happens now. That was one thing. As I remember, our class commenced with just over 100 students, and of that number, only five were women. The men were told that we were expected to attend classes dressed professionally, and that meant jackets and ties. And we were told that law school demanded our full attention. We were told that part-time employment was absolutely forbidden. And my other lasting first impression, I remember our first lecture. It was from the late Professor Terry Eisen, and he just immediately launched into a discussion about Hadley versus Baxendale, and I was just absolutely confused. Didn't understand a thing he said, but I got over that.
You said you came to school as a mature student. Was there a fair number of other students who had work employment before you started? Or before they started?
I would say it was over five, less than 10.
Okay.
Probably, yeah, six or seven of us.
Was anyone else, do you remember if anyone else in your class was a parent?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
two of my good friends during law school days had been out for more years than I had. My memory is that perhaps it was my best friend during law school days, Stu Van Mail.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he had ever actually graduated from the university. And he and John Proft, who also had been out working for a number of years, they both had children that were older than ours.
Today, there's sort of all these ways of being involved with the law school. What type of extracurricular involvements were available in the early 60s? What were you part of?
Well, during my first year in law school, I was commuting from North Vancouver. And that didn't leave a lot of time for extracurricular activities. And then, I'll have a little bit more to say about this later, but during my second and third years, I was employed two afternoons each week and on Saturdays and on most Sundays. And I didn't participate in any sports or any other formal extracurricular activities except the UBC Law Review in my third year.
What was your employment during your time at law school?
After first year law school, and I do want to say something more about this, we'll come to it, but I got a job working for a downtown law firm, Freeman, Silvers, and Kaufman. And that was a summer job, but at the end of the summer, they asked me if I would stay on and work two afternoons a week and on the weekends. And that was absolutely forbidden.
Yeah.
There were only two of us, to my memory, in my class that did work outside. It was forbidden. My marks were good enough so that nobody could reasonably complain. The other individual who worked was Len Doust.
Okay.
And Len Doust, I think pretty much everybody knows that, you know, he became one of the very most senior, excellent litigation counsel in British Columbia. We both worked because we had families.
Do you have any recollections of other classmates or professors?
I do. I did make some really good and lasting friendships while I was at law school. Some of those good friends are not with us now. My other really close friends in law school who are still with us are Selwyn Romilly, you know, Mr. Justice yes. Romilly, and Jack Huberman. And they are both still among my treasured good friends. And I have some pretty special memories of some professors. I want to mention four. J.M. McIntyre, we used to call him Jimmy Mack. He followed in the footsteps of his father, joining the law school faculty, I believe, in 1964. I remember him teaching us in second year, and I remember his father teaching us in first year, but his father died. He socialized, Jimmy Mack did, with some of us so-called mature students, and he had wonderful insights. I particularly recall his third year wills and estates seminar course. He figured out why I was doing as well in his wills and estates seminar course as I was doing, because I figured out where he was getting his questions from. And we understood each other, and Jimmy Mack had wonderful insight. Good guy. The other professor who I remember very fondly, Don McDougall, the late Don McDougall. He taught family law, and that was a subject which really caught my attention. I expect that some of my classmates considered that I over-participated during his courses. And then there are two other profs that I really want to say something about, Ray Herbert and Dave Huberman. As my first year was drawing to a close, I was offered summer employment at a small uptown law firm. I sought advice from Ray Herbert, who told me that the concept was a good one, but he did not favor the particular firm. So he then talked with Dave Huberman, and the two of them arranged that I talk with Freeman, Freeman, Silvers, and Kaufman. And to my considerable surprise, I was offered summer employment with that excellent firm. And at the end of the summer, they asked me to continue, or if I would continue, working at two afternoons a week and on the weekends. And I did that. Although, as I've mentioned, such part-time employment during law school years was absolutely forbidden. Dave Huberman taught company law, which was my very least favorite course at UBC. But I shall never forget the great kickstart that my legal career was given thanks to him and Ray Herbert. Freeman, Freeman, Silvers, and Kaufman, the firm imploded some few years ago now, but they were wonderful people and yeah. Excellent lawyers. And
what type of law mostly?
It was essentially a commercial okay. Law firm. They did all kinds of commercial work, and including very major commercial work, which was the very special talent of Morley Kaufman and Dave Freeman, who was my mentor during law school and for many years after that.
Were you able to continue at Freeman, Silvers, and Kaufman for your articles, or was your articles in another?
I could have articled at Freeman, Silvers, and Kaufman. In fact, while I worked there that first summer and then during the following 2 years, I was formally articled with the Law Society, but it didn't count. What it did do, it didn't count towards my year yeah. of articles, but what it did do was it gave me access to the Vancouver Courthouse and the Courthouse Library, which was not then open to the public. And so I could, after working those 2 days a week, I could go to the Vancouver Courthouse Library, and there was usually only one other person there at night, and that would be Mary Southern. But I didn't have to fight for books, and I had access to books that law profs had access to, but the students didn't have easy access to. And I mentioned Jimmy Mack's seminar course. Yes. I read a lot in the New Zealand Law Report. But you ask about articles. At the end of law school, we wanted, my wife and perhaps my kids especially, we didn't want to stay in Vancouver. Yeah. And we decided to move to Kamloops, where I obtained articles with Millward & Company. And Stuart Van Mail was articling there also. And Selwyn Romilly articled in Kamloops, and so did Hope Hislop. They articled with other firms. After my articling year in Kamloops, I stayed in Kamloops for another year. Norm Federley, who had been one of the three principal partners in Millward & Company, he left the firm, and he and I started a new firm, Federley & Barnett, which was very successful from my perspective, but it was a big step down in terms of income, and things happened. And I got restless, and I decided to strike out on my own in Prince Rupert after a year. So I went to Prince Rupert in March of 1968, and it was a wide open professional opportunity there. I didn't know people in Prince Rupert, but I had figured out that Prince Rupert was a place where I could anticipate earning an income pretty quickly, and it was better than that. I made money each month that I was there in Prince Rupert, including the very first month. I didn't have to borrow more money from the bank, and I was really quickly swamped with courtroom work, both criminal and civil, and with far more work, solicitor's work, than I really wanted to do. That wasn't my favorite. But I didn't want to remain a sole practitioner. I had really good office space, and it had space for at least one other person. I could never find somebody who was willing to come to Prince Rupert who was both sober and competent. I talked to people who would come to Prince Rupert, but they were either just not good lawyers ever, or people who had major drinking problems. And that was the first question that people asked me when I showed up in Prince Rupert, and the word got around that there was a new lawyer in town. People would come in, and they would, the first question they would ask, you know, are you a drunk? If I could convince them that I didn't have a bad alcohol problem, then we could talk and work together.
Was that kind of how rural communities were serviced by lawyers? Was it tended to be drunks who couldn't get jobs in other places in the province?
In my experience and my recollection, there were two cities back in those days which had particular reputations of having lawyers, too many of whom were either incompetent or drunk or both, and those two places, and I did have some experience with both of these places, were Quesnel and Prince Rupert. And there were good lawyers in Prince Rupert. One of the very good lawyers in Prince Rupert was a man who had a very serious problem. He had a very senior position with the Attorney General's ministry, and he lost that, and his friends bought for him, I believe, the practice of a woman who had been disbarred. And he, over the years, stopped drinking. It didn't happen overnight. And he became a judge. And he was a very good judge. And he never drank after. I mean, well, there were people who said that the chief judge had obtained his signed resignation letter along with his appointment to be used if he ever embarrassed the court, but he never did. So I stayed in Prince Rupert for 2 years. There were a few things that took me away. One, I didn't want to grow old in Prince Rupert, and I was so quickly becoming enmeshed in the city, some projects and volunteer work and that, and I could see that it would become much, much harder to leave if I stayed for another few years. That was one thing. But the principal thing was perhaps that my wife wanted to return to university and get a teaching degree. And Freeman, Freeman, Silvers, and Kaufman offered me a position in Vancouver. So I left in the spring of 1970. And sooner than I had any right to expect, I became a partner in Freeman & Company, which was a firm with a very challenging practice, an exacting practice, demanding clients, and they were wonderful men and great lawyers. I realized that I still had a lot to learn. You know, I'd been out practicing, articling and practicing for 4 years, but I still had a lot to learn. And Dave Freeman, QC, Dave Silvers, and Morley Kaufman were just incomparable mentors. But things happened. And kind of two things happened. When the Dave Barrett NDP government was elected, it quickly became apparent that the provincial court was going to be dramatically restructured. The male lay judges, and I say male lay judges because they were men, there weren't any women lay judges, who presided in all but BC's largest cities, were going to be displaced by professionally trained men and women. And when I talk about lay judges, I think that persons like you, Alec, and actually people who are now being appointed provincial court judges, they don't know that there were a great number of lay judges all around the province. And these were men, most of whom were recommended for appointment to the Attorney General by the commanding officer of the local RCMP detachment. And they were sent a criminal code and a form to sign, and now they're a judge. And they've had no legal training. They were all over the province. And when the first NDP government was elected, the Dave Barrett government, it became very clear that that was going to end. And the other thing that took me to the provincial court was my very good friend whose name I've mentioned previously, Stuart Van Mail.
Yes.
He had become a provincial court judge in Kamloops, and I visited him at his home on Shuswap Lake, and we were talking, and Stuart said, "Cunliffe, you know, you should apply to be appointed. You should apply to the provincial court because," in his words, "that is where the action is." And I've never forgotten those words, and he was, I believe, absolutely right. The provincial court was and is where the action is. My first day was in October of 1973.
Now, you talked about lay judges who would just be down at sort of the local RCMP and would be almost appointed by the same people.
Most of them. There were a few of the lay judges who were very good. There were a few of them.
Yeah.
When nearly all of the lay judges were summarily retired, there were four, or maybe it was five, who stayed on. But many of them were terrible.
Do you remember dealing with any of these lay judges while you were practicing in Prince Rupert?
Yes. My start was a case in Merritt. I acted for a young man, his name was Cootley, and he was charged with causing a disturbance by swearing and assaulting peace officers. The owners of a local restaurant had called the police to get rid of him, and the police came, and when they arrested my client and a couple of other guys, there was a real Donnybrook, and it took the police a lot of effort and some time and some embarrassment because it was publicly watched while the police struggled to get these guys in the paddy wagon, and they'd get one in and then go for the others, and the one that was in would get out. But my submission to the lay judge was that there was absolutely no evidence that there had been any disturbance caused by my client or the others, and that he should dismiss the charge of causing a disturbance by swearing because there was absolutely no evidence of a disturbance. So he agreed with that. But then when I said, well, now, Judge, you've dismissed the the causing a disturbance charge, that means that the arrest was an unlawful arrest, and he had the right to resist the unlawful arrest. Oh, the judge was outraged at me. He thought that I had sandbagged, and he found my client guilty of assaulting a peace officer. Well, a peace officer or more than one peace officer, I don't remember. What I do remember is standing outside the old courthouse in Merritt and telling my client that there's a really good appeal here. And my client was absolutely adamant that he wouldn't hear of approving an appeal because he said he was just delighted with what I had accomplished. He had fully expected to get a 6-month jail sentence, and the $500 fine was, he was happy with that. And he knew that assault PO in those days before that judge in Merritt was going to send you off to Ocala for 6 months.
Oh, wow.
And that was my first experience. But there were other experiences, most of them when I was on my own in Prince Rupert. And the one that will remain in my memory forever was a young man. He was a youth, actually, a juvenile delinquent in those days. It's reported as R versus R. But R was, remember, 16 or 17, whatever. He'd been charged with some minor theft from a store. I didn't know anything about him until the probation officer in Prince Rupert came running into my office one afternoon and said, Mr. Barnett, you have to come with me over to the courthouse right now because the judge is going to do something he shouldn't do. I had no idea what it was all about, but I go over with the probation officer, who I kind of was friendly with, and I stood up in court and I said, Judge, I've been asked to act for this boy. I have not had an opportunity to talk with him. I haven't had an opportunity to talk with his parents. I am willing to act for him. I know nothing about this matter. I need an adjournment. And the judge was very reluctant to adjourn the matter, but he did. And I really had no idea what was going on. But he put it over for a week. And in those days, in Prince Rupert, the provincial courtroom was in the top floor of the City Hall building, and the RCMP maintained the court records, and they were in the basement of the same building. So I went right downstairs and asked if I could see the file. And no trouble, they gave me the file, and there wasn't much in it, and I asked the lady there, will you photocopy everything for me? And so she did. And I walk out and I go back to the office and I look at what I've got, and I see that the judge has already signed the order raising my client from juvenile court into adult court. He had signed the order before the courtroom doors ever opened. So he did raise him.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't tell me that, But when it came back to court a week later, he went through a pro forma thing and on his own initiative raised him. And I remember sitting at my dining room table writing out a notice of appeal in very specific terms what was wrong. And I filed it, and then my client, somewhat wayward young man, did another minor theft in another store. So the next time I'm in court, the judge has got my notice of appeal on his desk, and he's trying to make sure that he doesn't make the same mistakes that I had so specifically laid out in my notice of appeal. So now I had two appeals, and I remember they were appeals to a Supreme Court, and I remember being Crown Counsel and I being asked to come and talk to the judge in his chambers, and he was outraged. He said, "Does this sort of thing really happen in Prince Rupert?" And I assured him that, yes, it really happened. He reserved his decision and made the right decision. He set aside the raise orders, both of them. I thought that he was much too gentle and that he obscured the fact that the judge had actually signed that order before the courtroom doors ever opened. I think the only person who could have really testified to that was me. And he didn't have my affidavit in front of him, I don't believe. But in any event, when I read the decision over, and I did before coming to talk to you, it was a very good decision. He was a little, I thought at the time, he was much too gentle. Now I realize it wasn't just the right decision, it was a very good decision.
Do you know why the judge tried to raise the youth up to a battle?
That wasn't uncommon in those days. Not only in Prince Rupert, it was common in Prince Rupert, it was common in some other communities. I'm not gonna say every provincial court judge. It would be outrageous if I said that. That particular judge was not a lay judge. He was a lawyer part-time and a judge part-time. Indian boys, Indian young men, got treated very, very summarily when they were brought up in court. And it was not at all uncommon for young Indian boys, not men, to be raised into adult court so they could be sent to jail. These are not singular stories. Indian people were treated very badly in far too many courtrooms in British Columbia.
In your career, you've continued to work on Indigenous issues, and we'll get to some of that, but would you say that this interest in the issues began during your time in Prince Rupert, or was it earlier?
No, it was earlier. I told you that I grew up in Vancouver.
Yes.
When I was growing up, I learned very, very little about Indian peoples in British Columbia. And I use the word Indian deliberately. It's not in favor these days, but that's the word that was used for a long time. I did know that Indians lived on reserves in North Vancouver, Squamish, Seashell, and there was one north of Powell River that I knew. But I did not know that Musqueam people lived very close to my own home in Vancouver in the Kerrisdale area. I used to go down and play on the banks of the Fraser River, and I had no idea that right next door there was a large Aboriginal Indian community. I was really proud of the paper that I wrote in grade 12 I came out to UBC to do the research. My paper was about the evils of racism in South Africa. But I didn't have any idea that Indian peoples in beautiful British Columbia had been the targets of specific racist attitudes and official policies for more than 100 years. When I was a university student, a student at MIT in Boston, 1 year, some friends and I drove down to Florida at spring break. And I remember being absolutely shocked at the racism that I saw inflicted upon black people in Florida and South Carolina and in Virginia. And then when I taught high school in Red Lake, Ontario, that was 1960 to 1962, that's when I came to understand that racism was a fact of life suffered by Indian people in Canada. That was really, racism is racism, but it was really, I recognized, this isn't different than what I saw in Florida, in North Carolina. There was a small Indian community on the outskirts of Red Lake, and the lifestyles of those people, and they didn't go to, their kids didn't go to school where I was teaching. But I saw what they had to endure. And that shocked me. But that learning didn't really advance until I started my articles in Kamloops and saw what happened in court down in Merritt, what happened in Clearwater. There was some late judging in Kamloops. And Prince Rupert really opened my eyes.
Yeah.
But then when I came back and was with Freeman and Company, I didn't have any occasion to see much, although I did some little bit of Crown Counsel work occasionally in Seashell, and I did see things there. But it was really in October of 1973 when I was appointed to Williams Lake.
You were on the other side now.
That my eyes started. I knew what I was going to when I agreed to become a provincial court judge in Williams Lake. I didn't want to be in Vancouver, and I kind of figured out that Williams Lake, if I was going to be appointed, I had kind of figured out that Williams Lake is probably where it would be. And I had worked in a little sawmill outside Williams Lake after grade 12. So Williams Lake was not unfamiliar to me, and my oldest son was desperately anxious to become a cowboy. And so went to Williams Lake.